Author of the Week, with Jessica Burtis, Rebecca Bond, Alex Lefchuk, and of course, another sensationally talented purveyor of perfect prose.
But who's the author?
Let's find out.
Now, in the mists of time and great experiences and so on, it's fair to say that if we go back to the 23rd of March 2020, we have a pre-pandemic environment. We're in the studio. We have indeed the wonderful joys of cyber attacks, fixed to remote car maintenance, and of course, the second appearance of Jenna Green, making a welcome return to the Southside Broadcasting family. Her debut was on the 15th of August 2019. And since then, I think it's fair to say that we've gone through a whole range of things, especially if you're actually dealing with the joys of Quill and Ink, a podcast for book lovers, and a whole stack of other things. Needless to say, we're absolutely delighted to welcome formally back to the Midweek Drive for her first ever Zoomer, of course, the whole brave new world. It is the aforementioned Jenna Green. How are you, Jenna?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So it seems as though those days of a couple of years ago when we used the telephone to connect, it's just so passé now. It's obviously, this is the way forward, clearly.
I think the phrase for 2020, 2021 is send me the Zoom link.
You know, I think you capture that in all sorts of ways. So, Jenna, update us. What's been happening? I know there's a whole heap of good material that we've got to talk about on the package today in terms of the wondrous stuff that you're doing in terms of fantasy and in terms of Reborn and the award-winning, of course, Reborn that we've actually got there. But share with us in terms of this whole new series, what you've been getting up to over the last 12 or so months.
Well, it's been an adventure. Teaching in a pandemic is swell. Raising a kid in a pandemic is interesting. And of course, trying to write and edit and publish and market books is thrilling and fun and different. Yeah. Luckily, I'm good at the online stuff, the social media, so that helps. But I've got a new release coming out, and I'm working on a picture book, and things are happening. It's going to be a busy summer.
Now, I mean, you mentioned, of course, your teaching side of things there. You're an elementary school teacher, and I'm speaking of this from a university point of view, that we had a what can only be described as a very, very rapid, steep learning curve to actually switch on to moving everything to online delivery, to the extent that actually we'll still be maintaining some form of blended learning in forthcoming months, etc., for lectures and so on. How did you find it with children? Because I know some of our students, some of them bought into it immediately, others a little less problematic. Obviously, you're reliant on the technology. What was your experience of the whole online world?
It was hilarious. 6 and 7-year-olds on Zoom, when their reading and writing skills are still fairly minimal. There was a lot of calling for their mom to help them read something that they had written. They showed me a lot of pictures that they'd made. And at one time, I had a bunny join us.
Wow.
So, you know, different than maybe what the older grades had. We had to keep them very short, but I got a lot of, like, our Zoom sessions had to be fairly short because their attention span is only so big, but I got to see all their bedrooms and all their stuffies, and mostly it was just making a connection.
A whole new world of home learning there. Got to ask the question as well, how is your cat, Thomas?
Oh, he's good. He's right here.
I felt he was there. I had a sense that he was actually there. So I thought, yeah, let's actually find out how Thomas is actually doing.
There he is. Yeah.
Seriously, all set and ready to go. I think I asked you this beforehand. Name possibly after the legendary partner of Jerry, or was it something completely different?
No, he was a rescue. And so Thomas, they'd already named him. And I wanted to rename him something clever. And my husband wouldn't let me because he thought a 4-year-old cat already had an identity with that name. I said, well, it's a cat, but okay. So I said I couldn't change his first name, but he didn't say anything about his surname. So I call him Sir Thomas Cattison, because there's always a loophole.
Yeah, absolutely. Always. Well, we'll sort of work through that. Now, let's turn on to Reborn, etc., and the line that's within that. Obviously, this is something that has continued to grow. It's a coming-of-age fantasy about the character of Lexil, who discovers through the marks on her skin that she is a Reborn, someone who's lived before. Because of this and the intricate mythology of her world, she's sold at auction and forced to become a slave. possibly like Thomas. No, only kidding, Thomas. Yeah. Abruptly throwing her life and everything she's known into a chaotic spiral at a time when Lexel is already struggling with the adversities of being a teenager, still reeling from the loss of parents. The effects of being portrayed as different take their toll. And Lexel is out to understand and discover even more about who she is and who she will become. So is this a character that is almost writing itself now? Do you feel that Lexel has kind of reached a stage now where, yeah, she dictates to yourself as the creator what adventures she's going to have?
Oh, absolutely. I interviewed an author a couple weeks ago that talked about outlining and how important it is. And I totally agreed with him when you're writing a first book. But when you're writing the sequels, the characters take over. You're as surprised by the plot half the time as anyone else. She knows what action she needs to take. And if I start to write something, it'll get tricky. It'll get tough. And she's like, well, because that's not what I'd say. And she's a character that really grows. There's three books in the series. Obviously, we're about to publish book number two, but book number three is already drafted, just needs to be edited. And so I already know a lot about how far she's going to go and how far she's already come. And she very much starts very docile. She gets called that a lot, very accepting of the situation she's in. Even though she's sold into slavery, she's like, oh, well, I guess that's what happens. But, you know, we're into book two now, and she is not accepting of that role. She is not accepting of the world around her just as it is. And now she's willing to take more risks and do things on her own that maybe other people disagree with. And so that's hard to be comfortable with the fact that the choices you make are not always supported by your friends.
So the subtext, obviously, for the second edition is Lexel Strikes Back. Is that the case?
Well, it's called, so the first book's called Reborn and the second book is called Renew. And it's a lot of renewing the emotions as well as the ideas and commitments she made in the first book. And it's one thing to have an idea, to say, I'm going to change the world. It's a lot different to execute that. And it's not easy. And there's decisions you have to make, and there are consequences. And so she has to decide how far she's willing to go and what she's willing to sacrifice.
Well, talking about changing the world, we know that Norwich is also a secret center of the universe for all sorts of things. And although she's not there at present, she's back in Lincoln. It's a delight to welcome to the Author of the Week special, Rebecca Bond. How are you, Rebecca?
I'm very well, thank you. Good to see you all.
Marvellous. So, Rebecca, you've had a chance to peruse some of Jenna's work. I mean, I just love the quote that you use, Jenna, for the Imagine series from, of course, Tolkien's The Fellowship of the Ring. Do not meddle in the affairs of wizards, for they are subtle and quick to anger. Rebecca, questions for Jenna?
Yeah, you were talking a bit about the character there, and I think she sounds absolutely fantastic. I was reading a bit about the novel, and I love the idea behind it, and I feel like the character's very relatable. And I was wondering where the inspiration for her came from.
Partly from a former student. She was named Lexi, and she was the youngest black
belt. She sold into slavery, Jenna?
No.
I mean, surely even in Canada, there are laws against that, I would have thought.
Not that I know of. I can check with her parents. She's like 20 now, so I think she's good. But she was 12 when I met her. And what's interesting about this girl was she was the youngest black belt in Taekwondo in Western Canada.
Wow.
But impressive. She really struggled to find confidence. I'm like, what? I have seen you like smack down an eighth grade boy that tried to touch your shoulder. But it was just this parallel of someone that had a lot of strength and a lot of skills, but didn't necessarily know it or know how to use it or recognize it. And so she was a big inspiration for the character. Obviously, Lexi, the girl, has gone on one path and Lexel, the character, has gone on another. But that original core of just not being aware of the power you have, that's where that nugget started.
I love that. I love that sentiment. And I just love that strong characteristic, especially it makes it even better now that it's based on a real person. And I love that you played on the name as well. I think that's really meaningful. I love that.
I thought it was clever.
It is. It is. I love it.
Putting into the whole context, I mean, the young adult market is something which has grown phenomenally over the last 20 years, really, Jenna. Are there any times when you sort of think, well, actually, I want to actually move this up and actually do a more adult version of the whole thing? Or is it a case of ultimately it's books for readers who enjoy it no matter what their age is?
Well, that's the joy of YA, is that I read a lot of YA. I mean, I taught middle school for 11 years and students would give me books that they enjoyed. And it wasn't like I was like, oh, I have to read this book to support my student. It was like, gimme, gimme, gimme. It sounds great. And statistically, more adult women, like middle-aged women, read YA than actual teens. We just love it. I think, though, the genre picked me. I didn't ever decide one day I was going to write YA. I mean, I started writing when I was 17, so I was a YA. But it's just what I decided. I think if I were to change, and I slowly am changing just a little bit, I would go down instead of up. I mean, my daughter's 5, so I've started to become really interested in picture books and how those are designed. I have one in the works. I am working with those younger students now, so maybe I'll do a middle grade book.
And feature some rabbits yeah. Meeting up with Tom. I mean, I think it's going to happen. There surely you can actually sort of go down that route. We've spoken a lot about Lexel, of course. What about Finn? What about the ally Finn, basically, who's obviously from that point of view once? Does Finn emerge in Renew as well?
Oh, yeah, we got to have Finn. He's throughout the whole series. He's an interesting guy because he's a dreamer. Lexel doesn't start that way. She's just kind of content with the world as it is. He's the dreamer. He's the one that wants to see the change. But when that moment comes, there's always that moment of panic and fear in him of, oh, right now, I was going to do it later. It later's now. Oh, but their friendship, their bond is they've been through something that no one else has. Obviously Sierra has, but she's 5. So, I mean, her perception, her ability to understand the situation is very limited. So the only other person that has been through all the trials and tribulations that Lexel has is Finn. And so their journey, where they are now, that's the core that just can't be replaced by anyone else. Of course, we're going to add in some new characters that are going to throw that dynamic off. We've got another boy named Kaylin that's going to be entering the mix. So there's that triad, that triangle. There's a lot of conflict in there of, you know, Finn's very protective of Lexel. That's their friendship is so tight and she's very protective of him. So to add new characters and new dynamics, there's going to be a few sparks.
Something we spoke about on your, I think both your previous appearances with the Midweek Drive is, of course, your fondness for dragon boat racing. And indeed, you're a keen dragon boat coach. Now, clearly, given its Chinese origins, I would have thought that COVID would have put page to that for certainly the last year or so in terms of dragon boats, etc. But how have the dragon boats been coming on? Are they likely to occur in some way, shape or form? Is it a case of don't be insane? We can't be 2 meters socially distant on a dragon boat. It'd be crazy.
Yeah, it's been really hard. It's such a part of my life. I mean, this year would have been the 20th year of the festival and it would have been my 19th year paddling and probably my 10th coaching. And so canceled last year, canceled this year. Yes, you cannot social distance in a boat that holds 22 people. And last year I tried to take up some kayaking and it was fun, but it's just not the same. And I really miss it. So when it does come back, not this summer, but potentially next summer, I will be on like 13 teams and I will just like have a tent at the lake and I will live there. And then I'll just soothe my soul.
This is clearly the Alberta Dragon Races are becoming sort of an internationally famous event, really. It's you know, who needs to worry about the Olympics? So we've got the Dragon Boat Races still over the horizon, which is excellent. Moving on in terms of your podcasts. I mean, clearly what we've done with the Midweek Drive is we have developed and evolved the Zoom format to the extent that actually, although we probably will go back to the studio someday before Rebecca graduates, for instance, in about a year and a half's time, the likelihood is we can do a lot of more things like this. It gives us more flexibility. It's opened things up. We do some post-production and so on. It's kind of become a little bit more a kind of go-to aspect. How have you kept your own podcasts going and have they evolved as well?
We started, I think, 3, possibly 4 months before everything shut down. So it's not like we'd had this podcast for like 10 years and we had to adapt. It was, I mean, we'd only were like 5-6 episodes in. We were still trying to get the flow. I have a co-host named Miranda. We've never met in real life. We live 2 provinces apart. So just trying to get that flow, and then pandemic hits but I mean, we record through online through StreamYard and so I don't know, not a whole lot changed for us in terms of like physically how to do it. We just evolved in how well we were doing it. I mean, at the beginning we were kind of talking over each other, or there would be pauses as we tried to sense who's gonna talk, and now we've kind of got a very loose format in that Miranda's much more not more interested but more skilled at getting to know an author outside of their writing, their personality, their hobbies, their skills, and just I have a little bit more formal training with talking about writing styles, techniques, and genres. So she kind of covers that and I kind of cover my piece, and that's helped the flow a little bit. Yeah, I mean, we were such a new show. We hit our 1 year anniversary a couple months ago, and we're just really proud of what we've done and how many different authors we've got to talk to. And thank goodness for, you know, this online communication that was able to make our show a success.
It's magic. That's the key thing. Absolute magic. That's what it's all about, really. I still sort of find it astonishing to actually work through in its own ways. But anyway, Rebecca, back to yourself. What sort of messages or questions would you actually have about Jenna's work, writing, and so on?
Yes, Jenna, you were talking a bit about why you enjoy reading and writing young adult fiction. But where did these science fiction and fantasy themes come in? Is that something you enjoy reading too, and you'd incorporate that into your writing? Where did that come from for you?
You know, you would think that I had spent my entire childhood reading science fiction and fantasy, but no. I mean, there wasn't a lot back then. There was like the Babysitter's Club and Sweet Valley High and Fear Street. There Lord of the Rings was around.
You got C.S. Lewis and his Narnia sagas. I mean, goodness sakes.
Yeah, but I never read those as a kid. I don't think anyone passed them along to me. I don't know what my mom was doing. I read a lot of Star Wars fan fiction because, man, did I love Star Wars. But the richness of literature just wasn't available back then. And then kind of in high school, I was introduced to 1984 and I was like, whoa, dystopian literature is a thing. And definitely that influenced me later on with the Reborn series. But honestly, I was 17, 18, and I was on a swing set, so I was super cool. And I just had this image of Kat just swinging back and forth on a swing, collecting her thoughts. And then the swing kind of stops, which is not something that should happen if you understand gravity. And I don't know, I just had these ideas, and that's what makes the Imagine series so unique, is that it didn't have a huge background in fantasy. So I couldn't copy all these. I'd read the Shannara series, but there wasn't a whole lot I could copy, which was a good thing, because you don't want to copy anyone else. And even though I have elves and
quartet.
Yeah, even though I had elves and dwarves, they were my own little spin on it, because I didn't know and didn't thereby have to follow all the little tropes and things. So
I think that's what's so amazing about fantasy, definitely. It's very open, isn't it? You know, you can create these wonderful and weird things, and it's very open, it's very unique. And I think you make of it what you want to make of it, which I think is why fantasy is so, you know, exciting to read and write. But especially, I find Do you find that children, because you work with children, you mentioned you have a five-year-old, do you find that the children inspire your stories or your outlook on fantasy and things like that at all?
Oh, they're starting to. I mean, Reborn came out before I started working with the young kids, and they came out before my daughter. Everyone thinks Sierra's based on her. I'm like, well, no, because I didn't know her yet. But
you might have lived before. She might have lived before.
I did edit Reborn when she was a baby, so I'm sure there's some little influences in there. But the hanging out with her, but also hanging out with her and her friends, the things they come up with, and then hanging out with these little kids. I mean, there was a wedding yesterday between a third grader and a fourth grader. It was a big production at recess. Like, and just the things that, like, I don't know, she's obsessed with lava monsters right now, but then you're safe from the lava monster if you put on your scuba gear, and, you know, like, there's no limits. They don't understand, you know, gravity and science, and so anything is possible. So I think definitely through, you know, I have a few picture book manuscripts that have been inspired by maybe her love of superheroes or her unwillingness to ever eat her supper. And I think over the next few years, as she gets even more of a voice and I get to know these younger kids that I'm working with even more, I think the influence will be coming. I think it's just starting to happen now, but I think it's going to come even more in the future.
Amazing, because I love children's imagination. I can speak. Imaginations, as you say, they're very limitless, aren't they? You know, they don't have these understanding of these big concepts, and it just comes out in this wonderful and weird way, and I absolutely love it. I love their imaginations.
That you can escape lava if you put on gear. Sure,
exactly. Exactly.
Bearing in mind,
makes sense to her.
Very much we'd like to work with magic. I trust you appreciate, Jenna, that I called on the deep magic to pull up a backdrop of indeed some of the authentic dragon racing in the background there, just in case we visualize this for our Festival of Learning and Festival of Creativity. It's actually there. And just, I mean, is that a typical dragon boat scene that we see there? For the benefit of the radio personnel, effectively, you've got, well, quite literally, a boat in the with a dragon at the fore part of the ship, etc., aft, and lots of people, obviously not socially distanced, paddling like crazy.
Yeah, but they look like pros, because ours wouldn't look like that. And I think one of their drummers is facing the wrong way, but definitely, you know, paddles in the right position, dragon head at the beginning. You can see a steers person at the back. Yeah, they just look like we're amateur teams. We're drinkers with a dragon boat problem.
We do go down that line, Jenna. It could be opening up a whole range of factors which we don't want to go into. And we've talked obviously about your latest text, etc. How did it feel when you picked up the Moonbeam Award? Was it a case of, yes, I finally actually rationalized and justified why this is important to me? Or was it just a case of, meh, it's another trinket, what the hey?
It was extremely important to me, but not for the reasons you might expect. It's not like, oh, I won an award. It was a first. I've never received an award before, so obviously that meant a lot. But I live in Canada, and the award was being handed out in Michigan. And so I had to decide whether I would go. And the reason I went is because I wanted to give a speech about my mom. And I managed to make it through the speech without crying too much. But Reborn has an interesting history in that my mom had been sick for about a year with cancer, but she was starting to get better. And just at the end of August, I started to write Reborn. And I wrote it through September and October. And then Thanksgiving weekend, which in Canada is earlier than the American Thanksgiving, she got taken to the ER and she was really sick. And they did a scan and they came back and said that the cancer had come back and it had moved and it was brain cancer. So I found out on Thanksgiving Day in an emergency room that my mom would die. So I stopped writing it. I took care of my mom for November, December, and the first 3 days of January, and then she passed. Didn't pick the book back up for a couple months. Then I started writing it again. And, it actually went fairly quick. I wrote for 2.5 months, big break in the middle, 2.5 more months. Finished the draft, hadn't edited yet, but finished the draft, get a phone call, and they say, we're going to let you adopt a little girl. And we get our daughter, and, you know, our lives change. My husband, my dad and I, and everyone is like, are we sad? Are we happy? We're confused. Eventually the book gets published. It's dedicated to my mom, and then it gets an award. So I got to go and say thank you to my mom for this inspiration, this connection to my life. She never wrote a word, but she was a writer. My husband, when he first started, you know, hanging out and stuff, he's like, you know, she tells these stories, but they change every time. Are they real stories that happened to her? I'm like, yeah. He's like, well, how does the ending change? If it's a real story that happened to you in real life.
Multiple dimensions, Jenna. Multiple dimensions. It's quite straightforward.
Like, she's testing the reaction. If she tells the story one way and you don't laugh, she's going to change it. He's like, that's not a thing. I'm like, it is if you're a writer. And he's like, well, she's not a writer. I've never seen her write anything. I'm like, okay, technicality.
Socrates didn't write her word.
She's a storyteller. She's a storyteller. And everyone always asks where I get my writing gift from, because everyone in my family is a scientist. So where does this little writer come from? And I say, my mom. And it doesn't matter that she never wrote a word. She was a writer. She just chose to tell them orally.
St. Catherine of Siena. We celebrated her feast day yesterday. Didn't write a single sausage. Now a doctor of the Roman Catholic Church. You know, it's an important thing. You know, had it all dictated. You don't have to necessarily have pen and ink in terms of the hands. It's all very important. Anyway, moving on to one of the other areas that I thought was quite fun. Heroin. No, we're not talking about drug abuse, etc. But we are talking about an interesting character who is a klutz, a dramatist, and above all, a dreamer. Morgaine. Does that kind of echo parts of yourself, Jenna? Is it a case of, no, I'm nothing like that at all?
Oh, no, she's the most me. At least the me I was in high school, in that immature but mature, smart but dumb, the dreamer of the wonderful things that will come, and I'm going to be rescued by a prince. And then you find out none of that really happens. It's and that book itself has been on an interesting journey. It's been published, and then that publisher folded, and then I self-published, and then I self-published it a while ago, and now all that software has changed, and it's been on a journey as much as the character's been on a journey. And it's the only book I have that's set, you know, in the real world, although you get these little snippets of her fantasies or her dreams, which you can definitely tell that even when I wrote that book out, I had to add that fantasy element. But I mean, a lot of it takes place in a drama classroom or a drama show. And so you have that cross between fantasy and reality and drama and drama. It's an interesting tale that's different than what the other books I've written, but also still has that element of the fantastic in it.
I'm also very impressed with the Imagine series, of course, because Becky is the lead sort of soul there in terms of heritage. She tries to adjust to life back on Earth, etc. We've got heritage, we've got reality, we've got Imagine itself from that point of view. Again, opening up the whole thing. And of course, it's Becky Thatcher. Now, that couldn't possibly be the Becky Thatcher that was much beloved in terms of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. And this particular text here, The Adventures of Huck Finn and Becky Thatcher to that side. Or is that a case of completely different? Different Becky entirely?
Totally different character, but I wanted to give her a literary name without it being too obvious. I mean, if I named her Hermione Granger, you'd all be like, oh. I wanted it to be a really, like, an Easter egg that not everyone would get, in that she loves books and she loves literature, and she's that iconic book lover. And obviously she goes through wonderful journeys of her own, understanding what's reality and what's not. But I wanted a really subtle nod to literature, that those who got it, and those who didn't would just be like, oh, that's her name.
You can't run a Samuel Clemens or Mark Twain thing past myself without expecting a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court to work through. You should know that. It's your third show, Jenna. You know, we might have magical dragon boat races, but we push this through. Rebecca, any other thoughts from yourself?
Yeah, you kind of answered my question a bit earlier with the story about your mum. That was an awful but really inspirational story, I think. But I also read that you draw from your life experiences. Is it those kind of experiences that you've drawn from, or is it part of characters? Is there a specific moment in your life that you've tried to incorporate into your characters? You know, what have you taken from your life that you've put into your literature?
I think a lot of it is the emotion. So, yeah. I mean, I put characters in fantastical situations, and I've never fought a dragon in real life. But I've had situations, you know, not yet. But I've been scared, and I've never fought a monster or been in a life or death situation, but I know what anxiousness feels like. And with the passing of my mom, I can understand loss a little better, or longing, for those connections that you don't have anymore. And so I think a lot of that emotion definitely plays through. I know writers that write about their actual real life, and I've tried that, but apparently I only work in metaphors. Who knew?
I love how you reach out to that human side as well, because I think it makes your characters very relatable to people of all ages, because it's a universal experience, these emotions, aren't they?
And people always think, oh, fantasy, it's not real. Well, loss is real. Struggle is real. Power, corruption, those are real things. It's just that we're exploring those themes in more of a metaphorical way, with a bit more action, a bit more adventure, a bit more magic and magic. So I'll defend fantasy till I'm 109 years old. I just think it has a power. Not that I don't love other literature. It's just that I just happen to love, whether it's low fantasy, high fantasy, urban fantasy, a dystopian fantasy. I think it has a real quality that I'm going to celebrate, and I'm going to write, and I'm going to enjoy.
I've always felt that behind every metaphor, there's an allegory struggling to get out. It'll happen, you know, just a literary line there, whatever. Jenna, how can people get in touch with you? Is the best website to go to jennagreen.ca to find out?
Yes, Jenna Green. Green with an E on the end, G-R-E-E-N-E. Jennagreen.ca. I'm on Facebook, Twitter at jgreenwrites. TikTok now, whole 3 weeks on TikTok at Jay Green Writes. And if you go on TikToks, I'm starting to do like author questions and author videos and things, because I don't know what else to put on there, because I won't show pictures of my
kids
from the head up.
Strike your dance moves, Jenna. You got to strike your pose. Wow. I mean, you know, I know it's radio, but that was just an awesome TikTok move from Jenna Green.
Quill and Ink, the podcast, at Podcast Quill. And then, yeah, Renew comes out June 21st, but you could actually pre-order it now. So
it's going to be fantastic. So we started off by saying you made your debut on the Madrid Drive on the 15th of August, 2019. The next one was literally the day before we went into lockdown in Britain. Of course, that's the 23rd of March, 2020. So the next critical question, which Rebecca is going to put to you, is what, Rebecca?
Jenna, have you had an enjoyable and lovely Zoom link with us today?
Oh, of course. You guys are so fun to talk to, and you love literature. So I love talking about literature.
There you go. Can't get any better. Can we welcome you back anytime soon then?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, summer's coming. I'm a teacher. Yeah. Woo. I can like sleep in till 6:45.
Amazing. Amazing.
Once again, the difference between the Canadians and the British, just writ large on that side of things, there. We'll just carry on regardless. Jenna Green, many thanks. Keep on keeping on, and bye for now.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, do you go on holiday? Do you stay at home? Do you have a staycation? Do you have a vacation? Does travel broaden the mind? Where do we actually stand with respect to all sorts of things in a post-pandemic world? Some of the questions that we're going to find the answers to in a matter of moments, because we're delighted to feature the regional manager for Booking.com, Ryan Pearson, with us on the programme today to talk about, indeed, the whole notion of that wonderful holiday. Ryan, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Good morning.
Excellent. Now, looking at this survey, it suggests that we have indeed, as a country and a nation, missed travelling, indeed to such an extent that 71% apparently would rather go on holiday than find true love. And 74% would prefer a getaway as opposed to getting a promotion at work. Those are significantly high figures, Ryan.
Yes. Yeah, so when people say they've missed it, they really, really have missed it. The research that we have that gains insight from customers all over the world, but also the UK, telling us how we all feel about travel at this moment in time. What the study shows is that all of us have missed travel. We've all got a deeper appreciation of the benefits of travel and that we cannot wait to travel again. And actually that overtakes some of those things that you mentioned there. So 3/4 of us would rather go on holiday this year than find true love, get promoted at work, or buy a new car. So it really is that important to us.
Of course, there could always be the ideal routine where you go on holiday, find true love whilst you're on holiday, and also get promotion through actually doing your work abroad as well. So, I mean, you could actually have a complete virtuous circle here, perhaps.
Yeah, you have a hat trick of those things and do all three at once. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on to obviously the notion of vaccination. I mean, I've had my first vaccination, I had my second jabbed in June. That's what I'm scheduled for from that point of view. But, you know, understandably, given obviously the general tenor of the news and the information with respect to that, 64% of us are actually not willing to travel internationally until, of course, we've been vaccinated. And I think that's not just important, it's also quite responsible to do as well.
Yeah, we really see that responsibility come through in the research. So people have confidence in the vaccine rollout and they tie that to their ability to travel. If they're confident in the vaccine, they'll be confident to travel. As you say, 2/3 won't travel internationally until they've been vaccinated. And actually, over half of us will only travel to countries once those countries have implemented vaccination programs. So that would explain why we see, in terms of destinations that are looking most popular for this summer, that domestic destinations are king. 8 of the top 10 most searched for destinations are now based in the UK, which is twice as many as 2020. Those destinations include Cornwall and Devon, Yorkshire, and the Highlands of Scotland. They've all seen an increase in searches, but we're not necessarily writing off the prospect of an international trip just yet. So we do see that the likes of Sorrento, Marbella in Spain, Dubrovnik in Croatia, all feature in the top searched international destinations for the summer. So it hasn't been completely ruled out. I think we're all keeping a close eye on what will be the green list countries.
Yeah, and what kind of trips and journeys do you think people are going to be going on? I mean, will it be the kind of the grand adventure? Will it be a case of going to places they haven't been before? Or will it be a case of just revisiting countries that they have enjoyed in the past and want to actually check out again?
Relaxation is the key. So a quarter of travellers tell us that a relaxing beach or a spa trip will be absolutely the first type of trip they take when it's safe to do so. In terms of action and adventure, only 4% will book any kind of active trip, and 5% say a city break is priority. So quite low preference there for that kind of trip. What's most important to people is meeting multiple members of their family, so the extended family or groups of friends. Over 3/4 of us say that's the priority when they take their first trip, is to meet up with friends and with family.
Working within the industry, obviously with booking.com, do you get an opportunity yourself to actually check out things, or rather like the rest of us, have you been in very much going stir crazy from being locked into the place for the same time, really?
Well, definitely. I identify with the research. I've been going stir crazy, and last year was fortunate enough to take a trip to the Highlands of Scotland, as many other people are researching this year. But for this summer, I'm going to travel to the lakes, and I'm going to do just what we was talking about then, and see friends and family that live close by. So it's definitely something that's close to my heart too.
And in terms of finding out further details about the survey, presumably booking.com is the place to actually go to dig down in terms of where people's destinations were. Because as we said at the start, this is very much an international survey of people and their views.
Yeah, visit booking.com for all the research details, but also to make a booking, whether that's domestic or international. And just our recommendation, opt for a flexible or free cancellation booking. And keep health and safety as a priority at all times. So wherever you're thinking of traveling to, check the restrictions and follow all the government guidance.
I think there's an old line about it's better to travel, hopefully, than to arrive. But maybe, as I say, the travel is also part of the enjoying the journey on the way. For the moment, Ryan Pearson, Regional Manager for Booking.com. Many thanks indeed. Stay safe and happy travelling, Ryan.
You too, Alex. Thank you very much.
So, spring, is it the time where a young person's fancy turns to love? Well, it would seem that is the case, according to recent research from Bumble, who suggests that it's not so much summer, it's spring that is the critical time when people actually are looking for dates and so on. So to talk about this, a fascinating insight into the human condition from Bumble, who better than an awesome individual, author of Body author extraordinaire, body confidence and life coach, it's Michelle Ellman. How are you, Michelle?
Hi, lovely to chat to you.
So, Michelle, were you surprised by this finding? Is it just a case of, well, what would you expect after a year in lockdown near enough and the pandemic, etc.? Obviously, we're going to go out there and go crazy.
Exactly. I mean, I'm single too. So when I saw the research, I was like, that is exactly how I'm feeling right now. I think we've all been cooped inside long enough. We've been trying the video dates, but it's time to go back to in-person.
So clearly, as I say, the notion of, as you said, being IRL in real life is coming to the fore here. And I see that the bank holiday is a period of time where people are looking to squeeze in even more dates. So you could well have to have all sorts of charts and coordinating things just to coordinate how many dates you're going on.
Yeah, so Bumble have termed it bank holidating. And I think just with any spare time you have at the moment, you want to be outside, you want to be enjoying the pubs being open, you want to enjoy those walks, and why not do it with a date?
70% of adults surveyed saw no problem whatsoever in going up to four dates a week as restrictions ease. That's quite a lot of dating if you're actually looking to work through that. That's almost speed dating, isn't it?
I mean, yes, and also that was probably the part of the research that surprised me most, not because I don't do it myself, but because I have received a lot of judgments for doing it. So the fact that people are getting less judgmental around it is a really positive thing, because frankly, I think men have done it for a really long time. It's only women who are just catching up now, and we need to not be judged for it. But even before the pandemic, I was going on maybe three dates a week. So why not up it to four after the pandemic?
I was also intrigued to find that almost half of UK singles admitted that they would ditch a prior engagement with friends or family to go on a date. I mean, I don't know. Does that show a kind of certain flakiness? Do you want to really connect with somebody who's going to ditch their family and say, oh, what the hey, I'll live for the moment?
Well, at the time when I was doing it, I must say my friends were very understanding around it. And I think it's only a temporary change. I think for the moment, it's okay to have your love life as a priority. And if your family and friends are understanding, then why not? I think the problem comes in when we see it as a judgmental thing when someone, I think there's a stereotype that we shouldn't put our love lives first. But if you want to find a relationship and that's a priority in your life, then what's the problem?
So in terms of obviously the bank holiday, which we're coming up to and we're passing through, we've got the season of bank holidays, I suppose. Would you actually turn around and say you're in agreement with people who say we need more bank holidays so that people can actually have more free time to engage in leisure pursuits and meet possibly the person of their dreams?
Absolutely. We've all been working way too hard for the last year. We've all had a bit of a miserable year, and it's time to have some fun and relax and have more free time. And I think having more bank holidays would be just a great way to celebrate us coming through this awful period and coming out the other side and making the most of actually being able to see each other again.
Technology is obviously there, Michelle. We're using it to actually have face-to-face contact through a Zoom for this particular radio piece, which is wonderful. But do you think we're going to see blended approaches? Do you think we'll actually sort of go back to real life stuff? I mean, you suggested earlier that maybe we do need to do that. Maybe we need a balance, perhaps.
Yeah, I think there is always going to be a mix now. I think people who weren't so great at technology were forced to be good at technology in the last year. And for me, I as much as I didn't love the video dates, I think I'm now going to keep part of it in that I think I'll probably do a phone call before I even do a in-person date now. So it'll definitely be more of a blend and more of a mixture. And I will almost see the phone call as like the pre-date before the actual real date in person.
And now you've actually been a contributor, a writer, michelleellman.com, of course, go-to website to find out all manner of marvellous things with respect to that side of things. But what would you actually say would be the best place to go to find out more about this Bumble research?
You can download the app today. You can start swiping today, find your match today, and sort out a date for the coming bank holiday for the Monday. I've got a date on Monday, so you can too if you download the app today.
Michelle Ellman, life coach and indeed general all-round ace soul. Huge thanks. Keep on keeping on. Have a happy bank holiday Monday, and we'll speak again, no doubt, in the near future. Cheers there.
Thank you so much.
Time for another Zoomer on the Midweek Drive for Siren Radio and southsidebroadcasting.podbeam.com. Keeping the COVID-19 bugs at bay.
Follow the money. That's often used by many crime writers in terms of the way to actually deal with issues and so on. And there are many football fans who'd say it was a crime that was almost committed against their particular sport with the recent, of course, establishment or attempted establishment of the European Super League. Maybe it hasn't gone away, though. Maybe there are all sorts of other difficulties. And where does our money go to? Well, perhaps we need to actually address the last question before we go on to the former. And who better than the Chief Executive Officer of the Association of Financial Mutuals, Martin Shaw. Martin, welcome to the programme. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, and very pleased to be with you today.
So, Martin, just talk us through some of the key things, because you stated something very keenly recently in which you said the core purpose of a football club, after all, is to deliver to its supporters, not to make money. There are lots of people in the Premier League who might disagree with that, I'm sure.
Yes, but probably not supporters. And let me start off by saying that I work in financial services, which is an industry which is not alien to the ideas of greed and not working in the best interests of its customers. The organisations I work with, though, are owned by their customers and therefore inevitably will be working in their best interests. So when you look at when you relate that to football, football clubs were built in the communities that they now operate in. They were designed over 100 years ago, very often formed by people in the local community or the local church, but they were always designed to be part of the community, part of the fabric of the town that they operate in or the city that they that they're based in. They were not designed initially, of course, to be a business, but as a way of using the limited amount of free time that people might have had during the Industrial Revolution. And quickly they became tribal. People began to see the football club as not just an innocent pastime, but as something which formed a part of their everyday conversations, something that they became very passionate about. And if you ask any footballer or any football supporter what their most keen interest is in football, they're not going to say it's about the money. They're not going to say it's about the share price of the organisation. They're going to talk about their position in the league and how wholehearted their support is for the club.
Clearly, one of the elements that was put forward is that, well, in America, you don't have relegation, so why don't we have a similar thing with respect to Europe as well? What's the problem? Again, there's a lot of issues with respect to that there. And I noted also you suggested that maybe Barcelona could be used as an example of how a member-owned club can actually grow and expand. Although Barcelona, of course, still, I think, are connected very solidly with the ESL. Or maybe we need to look at Bayern Munich, perhaps.
Well, if we start with Barcelona, yes, they're a member-owned football club. So the supporters have an active say in key decisions that are made within the business, much like the members of the co-op in the UK or a mutual insurance company, for instance. Now, with Barcelona, therefore, whilst they'd signed up to the ESL, ultimately the decision on whether or not the club was going to become a full participant in the ESL would have rested in the supporters. So at some point, the club will have had to have asked the supporters whether or not they agreed it was a good idea. Now, in Germany, as you mentioned, the Bundesliga rules require that 51% of the ownership of the football club rests with the supporters. And it's no coincidence, therefore, that no German football club signed up to the ESL. And I think, you know, we live in a world where hopefully democracy is very important. And if you ask supporters whether or not they thought that was a good idea, well, if they were based in North America, they might point to the success of the American football leagues there. But they'd also have to weigh that up against the fact that, you know, there's no World Cup in American football. There's no great allegiance around the world in the way that we see with Premiership football clubs in the UK. So, you know, those decisions that customers make about their ownership of an organisation are really important. And in Barcelona and in Germany, that comes as part of being a season ticket holder, that sense of collectively wanting to make sure that you make the right decisions on for the benefit of the club are really important.
It's often been pointed out that certainly if it comes to issues relating to finance, that neither FIFA nor UEFA are necessarily pure in this sort of instance. But let's move on to the Association of Financial Mutuals, and something which I think is really at the heart of this piece, Martin, which is ensuring that the public do consider, at least consider, where they're saving their money and also where that fits not only with their morals, but presumably with their ethical output as well. That's something I think you feel quite passionate about.
Yes, and in financial services, we have seen a significant change in the ownership of businesses over time. So that in insurance, for example, where most of my members operate, most insurance companies in the UK are owned by shareholders, and actually most of those shareholders tend to be overseas based. Now, the mutual organisations that persist, that are members of the Association of Financial Mutuals, are committed to the idea that they're serving the best interests of UK customers, and that they form an important part of the communities in which they operate in. That translates through to being more accountable to their customers. It also equates with very often better interest rates, lower costs, and a greater focus on better quality service to their customers. So for us in financial services, being member owned also means being better able to deliver the best interests of your customers.
For folk who are actually listening to this, Martin, and are thinking it's all very complicated, is there a kind of simplified website where people actually go to check out? Because information is out there. It's just sometimes it becomes a bit of a chore to actually find the information.
Yeah, and our website, which is www.financialmutuals.org, has a wealth of information about mutuality, case studies of consumers that have mutual products. And we've just been doing some very extensive consumer research, and we'll be publishing results of that very soon. But they point to a resurgence in interest in mutuality, and we're really pleased to see that and hope that more customers find their way to buy products from a member-owned business.
And it would be remiss of me not to actually ask you, Martin, do you have a particular football club that you follow yourself, or is that a case of I could tell you, but I couldn't possibly sort of comment?
For better or worse, and I say this slightly hesitancy knowing where you're based, Alex, but I was a fervent Grimsby Town supporter in my early ages, and we used to go and see them week in, week out up in Cleethorpes.
Well, we could say it's what the National League were made for in so many ways, but perhaps not, given the sort of demise. I must admit, I thought Ian Holloway was going to actually look after them, but sadly, his reign didn't last too long from that point of view. And given, of course, the Lincoln City aspect, yes. Although, again, hand on heart, I have to admit, I have been, since the days of Francis Lee and David Connor, a certain follower of that club now, which is now run at the Etihad, and indeed is, I think, financially reasonably okay, as far as I'm aware. That would be Man City. But there we are. It just shows the whole extremes of the football family.
Exactly. We live and die by the success of the team, don't we?
Martin Shaw, Chief Executive Officer of the Association of Financial Mutuals. Huge thanks. Delighted to speak to your good self, and hopefully speak again very soon.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye, Alex.